prepare to experience the strongest radio allowable by law. Secrets will be revealed. Myths dispelled. From the studio gym where excuses never apply, it's Superhuman Radio with your host, Carl Lenore.
Hey, welcome back to another episode of Superhuman Radio. Today is Tuesday, which means we'll be starting off with my co-host, Coach Rob Regish, in just a moment for the Blueprint Power Hour. At the top of the new hour at 1 p.m., someplace on the planet, we're going to be joined by none other than Ben Greenfield to talk about advances in recovery. This is going to be a very, very interesting show focusing exclusively on recovery. So regardless of what type of an athlete you are, you can get something out of the second hour. So hope you can stick around for that. But without further delay.
Calling all Blueprint Army. Fall in line. It's time for the Blueprint Power Hour with Coach Rob Regish on the Superhuman Radio Network.
How you doing, Rob?
Doing great. You've got me really intrigued for advances in recovery. I mean, you know I'm all about that.
And Ben's the guy to talk to.
Yeah.
I mean, you know what? If our industry had a rock star, it's Ben Greenfield.
Cool.
You know? So and he's very, very intuitive. He's very, very inquisitive. And he's willing to put his body through anything that he believes. So he's like me. He's a Wistar rat. He's his own experiment. So it's going to be an interesting discussion. How you doing, man? How you doing?
I'm doing great. You know, the shoulder's still about the same, but this offense I've been going on with squats, box squats in particular, has been fantastic. They just keep going up and up and up.
That's awesome. Well, you know, you got to back down just a little bit because at our age, when we push the envelope, we push the envelope of injury. We don't,
yeah.
We don't go, oh man, I can't go any heavier. We're never sensible enough to go, oh, I can't go any heavier. We're just like, no, I think I got another rep in me.
Yeah. No, it's undulating periodization. So I've built in downtime.
Sounds sexy.
Yeah.
Sexy time.
So,
what's new at the CoachRobRegish.com website? Anything?
Well, if all goes as planned, next month we will be rolling out the ultimate blueprint. And I know you've heard little bits and pieces about that. But suffice it to say, before it gets to a broader audience, everyone that's a Blueprint Bulletin subscriber or has otherwise, you know, bought a book or whatever from me, they're going to get first dibs on it. And it's some awesome stuff. I'm really excited to get it out there in the hands of the masses.
Yeah, that's exciting. Very, very exciting. And that's people can keep abreast of that at CoachRobRegish.com, right?
Yep, you got it.
So we start off with our first question. It comes from Jeff Waters. What do you figure is the best method of gaining strength? I mean, on your money lifts, like the squat, bench, and deadlift.
Yeah, you know, the answer is going to be different depending on the athlete, their level of development, and some other things. You know, a rank beginner, for example, is going to be able to add 10, 20, or more pounds to the bar on a regular basis. They don't need anything fancy to start gaining strength other than a whole lot of food. And just for the record, I'm going to assume the athlete is, in fact, eating enough. That's a big assumption, but all things being equal, it allows us to make the comparison. Intermediate and advanced athletes, on the other hand, are going to do better with things like loading patterns, otherwise known as percentage-based programs off your one rep max. Why more athletes aren't using these is beyond me. So let me compare and contrast what typically goes on in the gym with these loading patterns, and you'll see what I'm talking about. So the average guy's winging it, and he often enters the gym with maybe a vague idea of the muscle group or the movement he's going to use. Let's call it squats. But since he doesn't take the time to document his training, he doesn't know where he's been, where he is, and certainly where he's going. The mind, as they say, is a fickle thing. You know, did I do three sets of six? with 185 last week, or was it four sets of five? That matters, because adding weight to the bar, volume, or certainly density, pounds per minute lifted, determines overload. You know, it almost doesn't matter what this guy does today, because he won't know if it was more than last time, and ditto for his next workout. You know, by the way, I just described 95% of the training population. Now let's talk about the 5% who really know what they're doing. This guy walks into the gym, and he does use loading patterns or percentage-based program. He walks into that gym knowing exactly what his one rep max is, let's call it 400 pounds in the box squat. He knows precisely how much weight to use on every set, how many sets to perform, as well as the number of reps he needs to get for every workout. And every workout is carefully recorded, and each is a stepping stone to bigger things. In fact, in six short workouts, he's lifting 5% more. So his new one rep max isn't 400, it's 420, which, of course, forms the basis for his next loading pattern. That adds another 10% to his total, or one rep max, rather, in 14 workouts. So if you're training twice a week, about 7 weeks, that brings his new one rep max up to 460. The loading pattern after that adds another 7.5% in about 9 weeks, bringing his new one rep max to 495. So in about 5 months, our man adds almost 100 pounds to his squat. The question you need to ask yourself right now is this: how much has your squat moved in the last 5 months?
Mm-hmm.
If it's anything less than 100 pounds, you really need to do some soul searching, because that's what you're giving up if you continue to wing it in the gym. Now, I've got a half a dozen of these, and I just added a new one. I'm really excited about that one. I have mentioned these loading patterns before on multiple occasions. I had literally said they are the keys to the kingdom, because they are. Here's what's really striking. To date, I have yet to hear from a single person inquiring as to how to get them. It's a sad commentary.
Now think about this. The Germans, the Russians, the Bulgarians all gave birth to most of these loading patterns. There are variations of it. So yep. Just think about this. So the guys who lift heavy weight, like clean and jerk 500 pounds, they got there by following loading patterns. Think of loading patterns as prescriptions, right?
Yeah.
They, instead of you going in and going, I think I get 20 reps today in this weight, they tell you, you're not supposed to do 20. You're supposed to do 15 in this weight, because you're going up and you're going to do 10 in another weight. The bottom line is, none of us can make the progress. Once you learn loading patterns, then they're kind of in there, in your head, and you see these patterns when you start training yourself more intuitively. But these patterns seem to work their way back in. You know, that you're going to shoot for this many reps with each of these progressions. You're not just going to go crazy and try to rep out.
Yep.
And that's what strength's about. Strength isn't about how efficiently can you beat yourself to death in the gym. Strength is about how efficiently can you stimulate your nervous system and your muscles to be able to handle a greater load. And that's not beating yourself to death. Just look at how broken down a horse gets when it never gets any rest and all it's got to do is pull that junk cart around the city.
Yeah. You know, that's a great analogy. These things are very precise.
Yeah, they're prescriptions.
They give you the exact dose of that exercise to perform each time you step in the gym.
Yeah. All right, Steve Mendoza says, and how do people get the, wait, how do, if somebody wants one of these loading pads or you, what you have, how do they get it from you?
You can email me, or you can go on the website and you'll find where we have them up for sale.
Okay, the loading patterns at CoachRobRegish.com. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, Steve Mendoza says, you talk about fundamentals a lot. Which one is most important? It's a plural for a reason.
Yeah. The short answer is the one you're deficient in. And for the record, that's usually eating enough or sleeping enough.
But you know what? Or consistency. What, one of the things I didn't say earlier that I wanted to when he was asking for what's the best method, it's doing whatever you're doing right now long enough to see progress. Consistency needs to be one of the fundamentals. Don't you agree?
True. Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. So with respect to these fundamentals, you really can't pin it down to just one because they all work together. You know, for example, let's take the example of a guy who doesn't eat enough. His training might be on point. He could be using loading patterns. He's sleeping enough, but he finds that he just can't make the jumps like the program calls for. I can almost guarantee you I know what the problem is. He's not eating enough. Here's another analogy. Have you ever built a fort? I built a ton of them when I was a little kid. And I always built them out of something, whether it be snow, dirt, or wood. Trying to build muscle without calories is like trying to build a fort without snow, dirt, or wood. You can't do it. You literally can't. Likewise, you can eat the world's best diet. Plenty of calories, protein, good carbs, fiber, healthy fats, yada, yada. But if you lie on the couch all day, and you don't actually stimulate growth through proper training, nothing happens. The physiological trigger for muscle growth is overload. No overload, no muscle growth. Pretty simple. Now, let's say you're training and dieting correctly, but you're getting 2 or 3 hours of sleep every night. In that event, everything suffers.
Yeah.
Your insulin sensitivity goes way down. Your immunity craters. Your cortisol goes way up, and good luck making it through those grueling training sessions because it ain't happening. And that is why you hear me hammer on fundamentals. People listening know they're falling down in at least one of these areas, or at least you can do better. We can all do better. And until you do, there is no supplement that's going to help you nearly as much as shoring up one of those fundamentals.
Right.
Now, what I just told you was the truth. Yet, how many times do you hear that message from people in this business? Almost never. Seth Spanner, good friend of mine, he recently wrote an incredible article, and it's called Majoring in the Majors. It's going to be in next month's bulletin. It puts a much finer point on what I just outlined, including for the first time that I've seen some very savvy macronutrient splits per somatype, ectomorph, mesomorph, endomorph. Anyone that reads that and puts even part of it into practice is going to gain a lot faster, and so will you once you identify where you're falling down and then shore that up. Much more so than any supplement you could ever buy.
And that's the truth, because most people would say, you know, I'm burning the candle at both ends. I'm not getting enough sleep. I'm not doing it. Oh, take rhodiola. It's an adaptogen. No, man. Correct the problems.
Right. Get some sleep.
Rhodiola is not going to make up for you only getting 5 hours of sleep a night and going into the gym and crushing it every day. And when you're young, you'll be able to do it for a while.
And it comes back to
Oh, hell yeah. All right. Christian Kane says, so if I understand you correctly, you're into non-hormonal anabolics. One interview I read, you said they were the wave of the future. Why do you feel this is the way, and where are they now?
You know, to understand my answer, you first need to look at the political climate.
Mm-hmm.
Steroids and other growth hormones and drugs, they're politically incorrect. They have been for almost 25 years now. What is new is that the Designer Anabolic Steroid Control Act, DASCA, of 2014, included this catch-all language that pretty much shuts the door to any effective hormone-like substances ever being on the mass market again, at least legal ones. DASCA even has catch-all wording that allows the government to immediately schedule any item that quote-unquote resembles testosterone in form or function. So understand that for what it is. The new crime is building muscle, even with your own testosterone. Any hormone that does it, or even claims to, is going to be banned right quick. So the non-hormonal anabolic revolution started with creatine. You know, it's about as similar in form and function to a steroid as it is to zucchini. It's just not, you know. And if it wasn't so darn well studied and safe, I'm convinced they would have tried banning it too. As a matter of fact, I watched it happen one time. Other compounds include phosphatidic acid in lecithin granules, ecdysterone, more and more studies coming out supporting that, anacyclist perithrum, which I use in Progenitrex, lexogenin, ursolic acid, essential amino acids, and other compounds that work to varying degrees. The problem is this. None of them work like we want them to work, like steroids. They don't work that well. Witness, for example, SARMs and the recent government action on those. You know, they supposedly dock at the androgen receptor, give you all the benefits of steroids and none of the side effects. The reality is that they do the exact opposite. They give minuscule, if any, gains, and you get shut down and other problems with them. So the market will once again have to dig deep for new compounds that bridge this gap. Along the way, they're going to roll out a whole bunch of stinkers. They already have. And people are going to waste a lot of money trying them. My advice, wait until you've heard from a lot of people, both on the boards and in person, that XYZ product is incredible before laying your money down. Non-hormonal anabolics will get better, but keep expectations realistic. I just saw this on HMB, a meta study. It was posted on Subversity today or yesterday. No benefit to athletes or certainly weight trainers. None. Zip. Zero.
But wait a minute. But was it the free acid form?
Oh, yeah. Yes, it was free. Yeah. Hey, maybe we'll see it a third time.
It'll be a new product. It'll be a free.
Pull the wool over somebody's eyes.
HMB phosphate will come out next.
I like it.
Yeah. Let's get that going. All right, let's take a break. And when we come back, we have a question from Mike Flaherty. You're listening to the Blueprint Power Hour. Later in the show, we're going to be joined by Ben Greenfield. This is going to be a great show today. Stick around. I'm feeling grateful today.
Move over, superheroes. This is the Superhuman Channel.
Welcome back. That Atrantil commercial is a trip, isn't it, Rob? Did you hear it?
No, I didn't.
Oh, you must have got up. The new Atrantil commercial, they actually hired like an opera singer to say the name of the product. But say like Atrantil, and it's so funny. I heard it yesterday for the first time. It made me laugh. And by the way, the product works. I give it my two thumbs up endorsement.
Cool.
I'm going to tell you something. If taken long enough, this could reverse small intestinal bacterial overgrowth for those of you who suspect that you have SIBO. All right, Mike Flaherty says, like you, I take jujitsu. Is there anything I can take that will help improve my VO2 max? I get really winded during drills, but especially rolling at the end of the practice.
Yeah, well, what he means by rolling is you start out on your knees and you wrestle another person for real. And there's nothing quite like it insofar as cardiovascular stress. You need a good balance of power, speed, endurance, and agility that I haven't found another form of cardio that taps all of those yet, except for more rolling. Over the years, I have, however, found two compounds that help with your wind, so to speak. The first is cordyceps, which is a cultured Chinese fungus. More specific, cordyceps is a fungus that actually grows off dead caterpillars.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not making this up. If I'm not mistaken, there is a product out there called Cortigen 5 that is more or less the gold standard in that compound's category. Nothing dramatic, but a slight increase in cardio was noted. Actually, another one comes to mind right now. Buckminster Fullerene did that nicely for me, too. But the other, Buckminster.
Yeah, C60.
It was covered on SHR years ago, right?
Yeah, we talked about C60 a long time ago. Yeah.
You know, frankly, that one took me aback. I wasn't expecting it. So both of those compounds are worth experimenting with. Neither is a miracle. As an aside, you'll also get a nice bump in endurance from any quality ECTI product. Within the first week, this has always been true, within the first week, it's noticeable. And I would suggest either aponticum carthamoids for that purpose or turcesterone, which has been shown to increase red blood cells. The reality, though, is the single biggest thing that improves your cardio is dropping weight. Mm. That's all there is to it. You drop 10 pounds, and you'll find any cardio, be it long distance, sprinting, sled pushes and pulls, that much easier. Mixing up the different types of cardio also helps. You want to cycle through periods where you're doing sprinting, and then long distance running, and then hill sprints, sled work, pushing and pulling, tire flips. You'll be in much, much better shape. The key is to never get good at one type of cardio, because the other type on the other end of the spectrum, sprinting and long distance running, for example, you can get real good at long distance running. You're going to suck when it comes time to do your sprints, and vice versa. So work them both. Finally, an interesting story about how they deal with big, strong guys when they come into a jiu-jitsu school. When Americans, for example, visit Brazil, they are almost always bigger and stronger. So what the Brazilians do is they double or triple their warm-ups, and then they have the guys roll. Once your gas is gone, and you eat up that gas tank pretty darn fast.
The bigger you are.
The bigger you are, and if you're putting a headlock on somebody, you're churning through a lot of gas. But once that gas is gone, your strength's gone too. So in other words, they force the big guys to use technique by sapping them of their strength. And it really is an interesting dynamic. But it reinforces the old adage, strengthen your weakest link and you'll be better at whatever it is that you do. I rolled with a brown belt once, and he said, "You're incredibly strong." And I said, "Thanks." He said, "That's not a compliment."
It's a deficit.
Honest to God, that's what he said. He said, "That's not a compliment." He says, "You know, you need to work more on your conditioning." He said, "You could lose 20, 30 pounds of muscle. You'll still be a strong guy. You've got to work on your conditioning."
Interesting. Very interesting.
So,
the next question comes from Jim Cook. He says, "I'm confused about training frequency. How much is too much and how little is too little?"
Okay. So if you're on a good training program, your diet is in check, and you're sleeping enough, this is the question that you need to answer. Here's why. Let's say you're on one of those loading patterns I talked about before, and it consists of 6 work sets and 6 workouts. Jumps of 1 rep max, 5%. Doesn't sound like much until you start doing the math, right? I gave the example before of 400 or 420. The one thing those loading patterns cannot tell you, how frequently you can train. So at one extreme, you could perform all 6 of those workouts in 6 days. Of course, it's doubtful you could keep that up, and most trainees would fast find themselves overtraining, not being able to get the required reps per set, etc. At the other extreme, you could perform one of those 6 workouts a month, And that would represent severe undertraining, where you lose the training effect from the previous session. So it's obvious then, or it should be, that a training frequency somewhere in between is the sweet spot. Having run these things countless number of times, and with the feedback from many who have also done that, two workouts a week works for nearly everyone. If you can pull off two workouts a week for your big compound lift that you're using this loading pattern on, you're going to increase the amount of weight you can lift dramatically. Assuming that schedule, it takes 3 weeks to make that pretty dramatic jump. If you really want to get aggressive with your frequency, I would consider doing so just for the first half or maybe the first third of these loading patterns. For example, I just started German loading pattern 2. It's 14 workouts, jumps your one rep max 10%. What I try to do the first couple weeks is I try to train one on, one off for workouts anywhere from 1 to 5 or 1 to 7. At that point, that has me borderline overtraining, whereupon I decrease frequency to a one-on, two-off schedule, and then maybe even a one-on, three-off for the final 2 to 3 workouts. You know, what does that do? It's tapering, you know, and it works incredibly well. And it also gives your joints and mind a much-needed break towards the end. So those are some ideas about training frequency. But, yeah, it's interesting to note the one thing those loading patterns can't tell you is how frequently you can train.
Or how frequently you can run commercials, which we're going to run one right now. We'll be right back.
This is the Superhuman Channel. Evolution just got kicked up a notch.
Welcome back. Hi. Mike Ginelli says, how come professional wrestlers aren't as big anymore? I mean, some are, but they're few and far between compared to the old days. I mean, like in the 80s. And really, and even in the 70s. You know, I wonder if people realize that most of those wrestlers in the 70s and 80s trained side by side with some of the world's top bodybuilders at Venice Beach.
Right, right. Bruno Sammartino would train with superstar Billy Graham.
Yeah, Arnold, he trained with Arnold, too.
Yep. So during the 1980s, pro wrestling looked like it had raided Gold's Gym, and in some ways, certainly today as well. And a lot of that was due to the popularity of some main event guys who got a lot of exposure on national television. I think three of them in particular. There was a tag team called the Road Warriors.
I remember them.
Hawk and Animal.
Yeah.
And of course, Hulk Hogan. So, inspired by their success, there were a legion of new recruits that aspired to be like them. And the hulking physiques, let's face it, was a big part of that. Lex Luger, the Ultimate Warrior, and others are on record saying they saw the money these guys were making, the fame, and they decided to give it a go. Whereas Hogan was 300 pounds of muscle, and that was once an anomaly. I can remember saying to myself, he is who he is because there's not another 300-pound muscular wrestler I can name.
Right.
They didn't become common, let's call it, until about the early 90s. Now, when Lex Luger left Florida in 1986 and joined the NWA, Jim Crockett Promotions, there was nobody in the business remotely as well-built as that guy. By the mid-90s, though, his physique was no longer awe-inspiring as it once was. So how responsible were the drugs, you know, during this time? They were around, okay, but I wouldn't say that they were the only reason these physiques changed so rapidly. Now, they were common enough for the federal government to go after Vince McMahon in 1994, I think, he was ultimately exonerated of the charges, but the physiques in pro wrestling and the WWE suddenly looked a lot smaller and pudgier. And part of that was because under pressure from the government, he actually instituted a pretty stringent drug testing policy. And yeah, many guys were caught or fined and suspended, except the top acts, or allegedly so.
You know, he hired Dr. Squat, Fred Hatfield, and Dr. Squat hired Mauro DiPasquale at that time when they had the zero tolerance for drugs initiated, because he knew these guys were going to lose a lot of weight, and he didn't want it to be all muscle. And so Dr. Squat started creating their training programs, and Mauro used his anabolic diet. And for a short time, they kept these guys pretty beefed up. But there was no way to keep the new guys who were coming in to get them up there. They were able to maintain some of these physiques, but they weren't able to create average guys and make them look like hulksters. You know what I mean?
Yep, very, very true. Now, these days, when you do hear of wrestlers using steroids, yes, they're using it for cosmetic reasons, but also to make up for the rigors of the road. Look, I've been on the road in my previous line of work, insurance. It wasn't traveling every day like these guys do, but it really struck a chord. You know, your nutrition suffers. Your sleep suffers, especially when you're crossing time zones. Your training suffers because you're not able to do as much of it, or you're so tired and beat up by the time you get back to the hotel room. You know, it's hard to train, to say nothing of the, you know, banging these guys go through. Look, when you take a guy from the top rope and you throw him and he lands flat on his back, you know, there's nothing fake about that. It's wear and tear, and steroids helped with almost all of that. So they speed up the healing process and recuperation, and they make up for a whole host of diet and training sins. Personally, I do not fault those guys at all for using them. Right? They're not in a bona fide athletic contest, so they're not cheating.
Right.
They're just trying to make a living. So that's my two CCs. A great example of how WWE doesn't test some of its top performers, Brock Lesnar. Their explanation for not testing Lesnar is that he is not a full-time employee. He is defined as a part-time performer and thus is not subject to their wellness
policy. I'll be damned. I didn't know that.
So man, he's got it made.
You know, Bobby Lashley used to train here in Louisville at the powerhouse gym that I used to train at, Jeff Ruiz Powerhouse Gym.
Yeah.
Bobby Lashley is a genuinely super strong athlete. I mean, the guy is unbelievable. I've seen him put up 405 in the incline for reps like it's no big thing.
Wow.
And guy is really strong. And he had a great physique for a tall man. He was a big guy. But, you know, I guess they nailed him to the cross about drugs for a while. And then next thing you know, his physique changed a little bit. And the problem with this, there's a tug of war. The fans want people who look like comic book characters.
Yeah.
And the athletes want to give the fans what they want because that's their road to success.
Yep.
And in the middle are these bureaucrats who say, no, can't do that. We can't have this guy be that muscular. Yeah. You know, it just baffles me why the American government is so frigging afraid of muscle. I mean, the medical orthodoxy ignores its importance in health and longevity and health span and lifespan. You have people like Joe Biden demonizing anabolic steroids, claiming that the reason he wasn't a pro baseball player is because he wouldn't take the drugs. The reality is that Joe could have never been a pro baseball player, he had to follow his first dream, which is a pro bull S artist. That's what he's good at. He's a bean shooter. In Brooklyn, we would call a guy like that a bean shooter because he just tells lies left and right. So, you know, when you look at the way medicine views muscle, it discounts it. It ignores it. And in fact, it hates it. And it does everything it can to snuff it out. This is a perfect example. You have a sport here. It's not even a sport. You have an entertainment style that requires the athletes to use drugs to become big and muscular. And no one wants to let them do that because, God forbid, you're big and muscular in the United States. Oh, my God.
Right. Right. And on national television and held up.
God forbid a kid look at you and go, man, I want to get in the gym and train every day and I want to exercise and I want to be muscular. No, no, no. You sit there. Mommy will bring you more pancakes and milk. We'll be right back with you, okay? I mean, you know, like, what the hell's going on?
I don't know.
With this craziness? It's crazy. We're going to end up like that friggin' movie WALL-E.
Right. Totally.
Oh, my God. Don't be afraid of muscle, politicians. It won't hurt you.
Yeah, well, according to more than a few, building muscle is well on its way to becoming a crime.
Yeah, it's already a sin. You know, there's the whole host of people that look at anybody who puts any time in the gym and trains hard and is lean. You know, we're either, narcissists, all you care about is yourself.
Right.
Or, you know, no, all you care about is yourself sitting on your fat ass watching TV late at night eating pizza.
Yep.
You know, who cares about themselves?
Yep.
So it's really shame, but this country has been afraid of muscle. Not when my parents were alive. When your parents were young, strength was an attribute that men were proud to have, and women were proud to have a man who was strong. Today, strength is a bad thing. Women don't want a strong man. I don't want a strong man. I want a man I can push around.
Yeah. Yeah. Toxic masculinity.
Man. Yeah. Yeah. Toxic masculinity. Isn't that something? That's actually in the news today.
That's the new
toxic masculinity. You morons, we are the reason that you're here today. Masculine men who are willing to go out of the cave and find food to feed you and your brats.
Right. So the next time planes fly into buildings,
yeah,
you go out and find me a bunch of metrosexuals, and I guess
yeah,
they're going to have to carry the day.
Oh, I can't help you. I just got my hair done. All right, we're going to take a last commercial break. We'll be right back with the Blueprint Tip of the Day.
Spit that out right now. This is the Superhuman Channel.
You create misery. Have your cake and eat it. Take your place.
Welcome back.
And hear story and
now is where Rob drops the wisdom in the show, and that's the blueprint tip of the day. What is the blueprint tip of the day?
Tip of the day is two roads to getting the look.
Now, when you say the look, are we talking about how I look or that look where people look at me and go, wow?
Maybe both.
Okay. That's cool.
The look is quite simply a person's ideal physique, whatever that may be. So, you know, for many, that's carrying a healthy degree of muscle while still having abs. You know, back in my day, it was all about getting as big, as strong as possible, as fast as possible.
Abs really didn't matter back then.
Yeah. Whatever it is, let's say you're a long way from it and you're getting frustrated. So it's at this point that an athlete has a critical decision to make. Do I stay natural and maybe try something new, or do I go to the dark side? So I'd like to consider both scenarios. Mr. Natural, on the one hand, he decides to stay that way. In order to reach his goals, though, he knows something needs to change. So he considers alternatives. Training is up first. Deep down, he knows he can do better because he's just winging it. So he hires a coach or trainer and gets on a new program. Maybe using percentage-based, you know, loading patterns like I spoke of before. He's also cycling his intensity. He's going to train flat out for 3 weeks. He's going to rest or deload for one. He also knows he can do better at the dinner table. So he nails himself to a new strategy. He starts rotating days of intermittent fasting and traditional bodybuilding style eating, 5 to 6 meals a day. He cleans everything up. He drops all the junk from his diet, except for a once-a-week cheat day. He also knows his sleep habits are dodgy, so he resolves to get a solid 8 to 9 hours every night by being in bed at the same time every night and making sleep a priority. And finally, he decides to clean house with respect to his gung-ho supplement intake. He's not going to be shotgunning everything anymore. He's going to be sticking with high-quality protein, a creatine, and an intra-workout for faster recovery. Over the next 6 weeks, he makes more progress than he has over the last 6 months. It isn't magic. It's just that he's dramatically improved his fundamentals, which are the pillars of success in this business, right? Training, diet, and rest. On the other hand, we get Mr. Darkside, and he goes Darkside in no small way. He's on test, he's on trend, and he's on D-ball. He's going to train the same way he always has, ditto for diet, and if anything, he's going to get less rest than he did before. It doesn't matter, because over the next 6 weeks, he makes more progress than he did over the last 6 years. He is a god in the weight room, and he has all the answers, or so he thinks. Because when Mr. Darkside comes off, either via legal or physical problems or his source dried up, whatever, where is he going to be? He's going to be shrinking back to become Mr. Normal and far, far away from achieving his goal. Even worse, and this is the big difference between these two, he hasn't learned anything new because he didn't do anything to his fundamentals like Mr. Natural did. People stop coming to him for advice in the gym, or worse, he will stop going to the gym altogether, right? I mean, what's the point? It's depressing as hell, and frankly, it's embarrassing when you're losing 20 or more pounds of muscle. I mean, everybody knows what's up. I am not here to judge those people. But who would you rather be at the end of 6 weeks? You know, Mr. Natural, who learned something and took some steps to his ultimate goal.
And it's sustainable.
Right. Or Mr. Darkside. The moral of the story here is this. The more you rely on ever-escalating doses of anabolics, the less you learn about what really builds muscle. Heavy weights, progressive overload, running very precise training protocols, listening to your body as to when to push it and when to pull back, and how to stay healthy, all those things are invaluable. If you do use anabolics, understand that learning more about your training, diet, and rest will only benefit you. It's only going to make your drug cycles that much more effective, and you will likewise be in a better position when you come off. It's something to ponder as you make your next move in the gym. So really think about it. Mr. Natural, over those 6 weeks, he learns a lot, and he tightens up his fundamentals a lot, and he's a few more steps closer to his goal. Mr. Darkside is going to let the drugs do all the work. And when he comes off of them, he really hasn't learned anything new. And if anything, he is further away, much further away now than Mr. Natural was. He'll look great over 6 weeks, but you can't maintain that forever.
You know who Mr. Darkside reminds me of when you tell the story that way?
Who?
The guy who goes to his 20th year reunion. So he rents a Mercedes, you know, he takes his credit cards and he bangs out and he buys all new clothes. He's going to put on a front when he gets there that he's real successful. He's driving a flashy car. But when the weekend is over, he goes back, he turns the car in, now he's freaking out how he's going to pay for the suits that he bought, and he goes back to his trailer home. And it's like, you know, look, there are those of us who use drugs and we've used them long term because that's what we did.
Yep.
But there's the person you're talking about who in most cases is a newbie and getting ready for spring break and wants to be on something for spring break, wants to be all thug. And I'm going to be on something. I'm going to be big and strong, and I'm going to let people know, because when I get drunk, I'm going to say, well, I'm on roids, man. So get out of my way. I'll pop a zit on you. You know, it's like these people are just stone cold assholes. That's all they are.
Yep.
You know what? Put the time in the gym. Be humble. Don't, you know what? Do you really want to be as big as Ronnie Coleman? Probably not. 99% of the population doesn't want that. That's a big responsibility.
Yeah. Or
most of us just want to look like Marky Mark in the underwear commercial in Times Square when I was a kid. You know, I want to have abs. I want to have nice shoulders. I want to look good. I want women to look at me and go, damn. I don't want guys to look at me and go, wow. You know, wrong audience, man. Wrong audience.
Now, this has been a very fun show. I want you to know you have inspired me.
Me?
Because as soon as I hang up, I am going to work immediately on HMB methylphosphate.
There you go. That's it. Acid. Methylphosphate but put Alka-Seltzer in it. No, methylphosphate and acid. We figured out that it's the acid that was the problem. So we put antacid in it. There you go. All right, listen, it's been a fun show. It really has. It always is. All right, so thank you very much for everything you do. And we'll talk to you next week. How's that sound?
All right. Thanks, Carl.
All right, brother. All right, we're going to take one quick commercial break. And when we come back, we're going to be joined by none other than Ben Greenfield. Stay tuned.
This is the Superhuman Channel, where brawn and brains finally meet.
Welcome back. So, if our industry has a rock star, it's my next guest. And the reason for that is because he's a down-to-earth kind of guy. He has opinions. He's unapologetic for who he really is. But more importantly, he writes checks, and he makes his body cash those checks. In some cases, I think of him in the vein of my own personal journey. My body has been my experiment. I've said many times I'm going to leave my body to science because I want somebody to break me down and see what I've done to myself over the 112 years that I will live. With that being the case, I want to welcome Ben Greenfield. How you doing, Ben?
Hey, I'm good. I admittedly don't really play any guitar riffs or sing quite as well as any rock star I can think of.
But you know what I mean. You're definitely the rock star of physical culture today. You've done, first of all, you're highly intelligent. You have a work ethic when it comes to working hard at the things that you do, but also you're somehow you kind of like created this persona that is kind of big, even bigger than you now, and it's just amazing to me. It really is.
Well, according to the way my muscles feel right now after my kettlebell workout this morning, I do work hard. I will give you that.
Yeah, I know that. So we want to talk about recovery. Very few people probably push the envelope of recovery as hard as you do. So what's really hot right now? What's emerging? What is your focus when it comes to recovery?
Oh man, there's a lot out there now when it comes to recovery. Top of mind is what I'm doing right now while I'm standing at my desk. I've got infrared light, basically kind of bathing my body for muscle recovery. And there's some really interesting research on near infrared light specifically. So I literally have like a giant panel behind me, and I'm standing here with my shirt off, just shining it on myself.
Now, are these the red lights, or these lights that you cannot see? Like I know 880 to 890 nanometers can liberate nitric oxide from the from plasma that can actually start to heal things faster. In fact, the FDA approved that therapy for wound healing in diabetics.
Exactly. And you get the increase in microcirculation from the nitric oxide. You also get a little bit of an upregulation of cytochrome C oxidase activity. So there's a little bit of a mitochondrial effect as well. And you can use these type of things as like a full body type of light therapy strategy. Or, you know, the other thing that I was doing while I was upstairs, you know, drinking my smoothie after the kettlebells was they make these, originally designed for Alzheimer's and dementia patients, these devices that you can wear on your head that result in a similar response in neural tissue. There's a company called Vilite that makes one. It's again based on the concept of photobiomodulation, but you can wear it on your head. And they have two models. One does 10 hertz, and then one generates more of a gamma frequency, which would be more indicated for example, for tackling neurofibrillary tangles, and that'd be at about 40 hertz, but I do both. I do neural photobiomodulation, and then like full body near infrared for what you alluded to, the nitric oxide, the mitochondrial advantage, and some of the research that's been done on recovery, specifically in athletes.
I know that you live in Washington State and one of the most beautiful states in our country, but unfortunately, one of the grayest during the winter and you know the rainiest and so on and I'm listening to you, and I can see why you would do this. But if you lived in a sunny tropical climate, wouldn't you just go out and stay on the beach most of the day?
Yeah, you could. I mean, the only issue there is, of course, and I have nothing against UVA and UVB radiation in moderation, right? But you would just want to take into account the potential for skin radiation with excessive UVA and UVB, but absolutely. I mean, nothing's going to beat the sun, but the fact is, you know, I got to be indoors working you know, I'm not going to go outside. You know, right now it's you know, 30 some degrees. I'm not going to go out there and drink my smoothie out in the sunshine. So,
my point.
So, yeah.
So you harness this stuff and bring it indoors. Now, what about, since you were talking about Hertz, what about, PEMF, pulse electromagnetic field devices. I think you and I are both fans of these things. I've been sleeping with an Earth Pulse under my bed for the better part of 13 years now. And what do you think their role is, both intrinsically as creating this more ancestral relationship with the Earth, but more importantly, cocooning us from all of the EMF and RF plasma that we live in every day?
Yeah, I mean, we certainly see from grounding or earthing, you know, going outside in your bare feet, which I did do last night, even though it was pretty cold. I just flew back in from Minneapolis in that Weston A. Price conference over there. And so because I spent a lot of time on the airplane yesterday, I did grounding and earthing, and primarily I do that to simply restore my ionic potential after being above the ground at 40,000 feet. But when it comes to recovery, this idea of PEMF therapy from either the earth or from a device, you know, like that Earth Pulse that you're using, which I like. You know, there's a lot of devices out there. I've got a Earth Pulse, I have a Flex Pulse, I have a Osca Pulse. There's all sorts of PEMFs.
Right.
But they stimulate what's called myosin phosphorylation. So that just allows for production of ATP. And so when you think about the ATP depletion that occurs with strenuous activity, that can result in, you know, a decreased recovery process or inability to hit as hard the next day or later on in the day. PEMF can really help with ATP restoration. And you look at a lot of the other things we just talked about with photobiomodulation, and magnetic fields can achieve the same thing. They can increase the uptake of oxygen into muscle. They can, as you alluded to, some really interesting studies on the effects of PEMF in terms of their ability to be able to repair some of the damage that occurs from non-native EMFs, such as you might get from your cell phone, which admittedly, you know, a cell phone is a pulsed electromagnetic field, but it's at a much higher frequency than these other PEMF devices. I mean, we're talking about, you know, tens of thousands of hertz, you know, compared to, you know, most PEMF devices Well, if you look at them for repair and recovery of muscle tissue, they're generally at about 100 hertz. If you look at you know, the use of PMF for something like alpha brainwave production or focus, it'd be about 10 hertz.
Right.
You know, when you're sleeping with the earth pulse, usually you've got that thing set, you know, I like to sleep with PMF at about 3 up to a maximum of that Schumann resonance,
7.
Between
8.
7 and 8 hertz.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, it's a very, very versatile form of therapy to have around. And yeah, I'm a fan of PMF, and you know, I've always got a device laying around or under my bed, or, you know, I travel with them. They're quite portable. So yeah, that's another great strategy.
I wonder, you know, I often wonder the incidence of some of these higher frequencies that are now man-made, which we like to call, you know, EMF pollution, if you will. I often wonder the incidence of them, because they could have been, you know, generated from the sun and shined down upon Earth. But I often wonder the incidence of them through our evolutionary journey. We know that the Schumann resonance is tied closely to atmospheric electrical discharge, and it's kind of this cyclic recycling of energy. And we know that as sun and air and water has had a profound effect on our evolution, those electromagnetic frequencies did as well. What was the incidence of 4.2 gigahertz actually happening a million years ago?
A 4.2 gigahertz?
Yeah, most house phones today, most house cordless phones.
I was going to say, that's a huge frequency. You know, what you say kind of brings up this idea, and I was speaking with a PMF researcher a few weeks ago about this. You know, we hear about the Schumann resonance, right? Everybody says Schumann this and Schumann that, and that's that 7.83 that you talked about. But we see a whole set of peaks
in
the Earth's electromagnetic spectrum. Like we see everything from 7.83 all the way up
60.
To I've seen values above 30. I haven't seen as high as 60, even though that might be the case. But this researcher even brought up the fact that we have magnetite, a mineral present in human tissue that transmits these frequencies from 3 hertz up to a little bit above 30 hertz. Naturally. So there's a whole range of frequencies that would be considered native or natural EMFs that mm-hmm. are produced by some of the things you mentioned, like, you know, solar winds and the planets and the magnetic field of rocks and a lot of these things that we don't touch as much these days. And, you know, even though the Earth is bathed in all these artificial electric and magnetic fields, it's very interesting that by returning to nature or by using any of these, you know, modern PMF devices, I'm kind of a fan of doing a little bit of both. We can get exposed to a wide variety of fields that frankly go far above and beyond just this basic Schumann resonance.
Yeah. No, and the Schumann resonance. So what people need to understand is that right now our planet is being struck probably 1,000 times an hour with lightning from outside of our atmosphere, and that discharge actually reaches the Earth and bounces into the core and comes back out as an electromagnetic waveform. And so depending on the activity, the Schumann resonance can get as high as 60 hertz if we're having a lot of atmospheric electrical discharge activity. As you point out, 7.8 seems to be the quote mock idle. Like that's like where it is most of the time. But there's parts of the world, ironically, some of those parts of the world are also hailed as spiritual centers of mm-hmm. the world, like Taos and Santa Fe, New Mexico, where the Schumann wave seems to hang out at 9.6, 9.5. And, you know, they say, well, it has something to do with the thickness of the crust of the Earth, and it has this and it has that, and, you know, the attenuation of the rock form above it. But, you know, the whole electromagnetic field thing rides in the back of my mind all the time as an ignored, unforgotten aspect of our evolutionary journey that we have just taken for granted. And, you know, we've slowly
not just ours, but animals as well. I mean, it's really interesting. If you look into the effect of low frequency electromagnetic fields versus high frequency electromagnetic fields on everything from like bees to cows, it's fascinating how many animals will, for example, they'll gather around some of these areas that you talked about. We see cows, for example, gather around these natural areas where there's low frequency EMF, and they're extremely sensitive to these earth currents, but they're also extremely sensitive to radio frequency exposure, and specifically in terms of oxidative stress. So it's not just humans, but every other animal on the face of the planet responds to these things when it comes to either better healing and recovery, which was how we got on this topic in the first place, or else more cellular damage.
Yeah, no, and I want to take our first commercial break, and when we come back, we'll get back on the whole recovery. We haven't left it, really. But I want to discuss some other things that I have in mind that I have a feeling I'd like to get your opinion on, okay? We're talking with Ben Greenfield. What's your website? BenGreenfieldFitness.com?
Yeah, just BenGreenfieldFitness.com.
There you go. So that's where you can learn more about Ben. Most of you probably know everything you need to know about Ben already, but stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Spit that out right now. This is the Superhuman Channel.
Welcome back. We're talking with Ben Greenfield today about advances in recovery. I just want to circle back real quick. One quick question about grounding. How long do you generally ground like you did last night, kind of for that acute effect after being up in the air all day?
Until my feet get really cold. You know, for me, I'll generally go about 15 to 20 minutes. Yeah. I'll walk around. Do anything except talk on my phone. I'll breathe. I'll get a few things done. You know, we've got a big wood burning stove here, so I'll occasionally. I don't necessarily recommend this, but I'll chop wood in my bare feet. Hmm. I have a little cold pool, which is also, by the way, great for recovery. I had a crane drop this 19-foot endless pool back behind my house in the forest. So I'll walk out there and I'll jump in the cold pool and then hop in the hot tub and walk back into the house. So. I don't have a hard and fast rule that I follow. And frankly, I haven't seen a lot of research on a set amount of time. I just go out of my way to get in touch with the planet after I've been on an airplane.
Yeah. So interestingly, when I was at a Quest last year working on a project, they had a guy in there and they were testing this whole grounding concept. And he was drawing blood before and after grounding for 15 minutes. And are you familiar with the Rouleau effect of how red blood cells will stack end to end like a stack of quarters?
The Rouleau, are you referring to like what you look at with a live red blood cell?
Yeah,
analysis?
Yeah. So the Rouleau effect is when – so normally your blood cells should kind of just kind of be bouncing off of each other and just kind of each one of them in its own kind of geosynchronous rotation, whatever it wants to do. But the Rouleau effect is a actual – dysfunction in the charges of the cells that cause them to stack like casino chips, like 5, 10, 15 of them. And so when they come to a small blood vessel, they crash into that small blood vessel, you know, none of them wanting to let go of their charge and unstack, and they actually have the potential to cause thrombosis. They can start out as small venous thrombosis that you don't even know, but it just hangs there, and then other Rouleaued red blood cells stack, and next thing you know, you got a little log jam going on. And the Rouleau effect is actually quite sinister because it happens in most of us. We're starting to learn, and grounding completely changes the charges of the red blood cells, where they just unclench and let go, and they all go back into their own.
The charges of a lot of cells. I mean, healthy cells have this transmembrane potential. Generally, you know, based off of what Otto Warburg studied, it's about negative 70 to negative 90 millivolts. And what we see in unhealthy cells, or even in the cells of people who have been, like, you know, on a plane flight, not even a long plane flight, right, just getting up above the planet Earth for a couple of hours, you'll get it dropping down to about negative 50 millivolts. And even low, if you look at like cancer cells or inflamed cells, you know, negative 120 millivolts mm-hmm. or more. And so that's what PEMF does is, you know, in addition to a couple of the other things that we talked about before the break, it improves ion exchange. It increases the flow of oxygen and cellular nutrients through the membrane. And so that's one of the big ways that it works on not just red blood cells, but a lot of different cells. So that doesn't surprise me. I wasn't familiar with that effect, but it doesn't surprise me.
And one last thing on grounding. For those of you out there who are like, damn, I'm going to have to start going outside. When you shower, you're grounding. I've done this at home with a volt ohm meter. I've put one lead in the stream and touched the other lead. You got to be careful about this. Into the ground side of an electrical outlet, the third prong. And it immediately goes to zero. It goes to ground. So that water stream and the ground side of your electrical system are all connected through the earth.
That sounds slightly safer, but just slightly safer than having a toaster in your bathtub.
Yeah, no. Listen, I literally like was ready to like crap my pants when I did this, but I thought I have to do it because where can I find a true grounded where I can say, oh, absolutely, I was in ground. I wasn't like in this screw that's in the wooden wall here. And so I got alligator clips and doubled up the leads, and I stuck it in the ground side of the electrical outlet first and left that hanging in there. And then I went into the shower and didn't step in the shower and just put the lead in the stream of the shower. And I looked down at the volt ohmmeter and it went to ground. I went, oh my God. So no wonder why great ideas come to people when they're showering.
It's crazy. It reminds me of this. Have you heard of this concept of actually taking like a sand or an earth bath? Like there's this, I know that in Egypt, there was a story about this. It was last year sometime. Somebody sent me this article where these folks will bury themselves in the sand for like rheumatism and joint pain, and they'll even do it for like infertility and impotence or erectile dysfunction. Like they'll bury themselves in the sand and just stay there for like half the day buried in the sand to treat medical therapies.
I believe it. People think it's crazy, but I believe it. I'm starting to understand that it's what we've removed from our nature that is killing us now, and we need to reconnect with it. So that's it. So if you're showering every day, stay in the shower a little bit longer, you're grounding. Okay, so I know that you're big on hacking your sleep, and sleep probably is the most profound opportunity for recovery. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so what's new on the Ben Greenfield sleep hack routine?
Well, we talked about PEMF. Let me think. You know, when it comes to hacks for sleep, I would say that, you know, I like to step back and look at things from a standpoint that a lot of people don't look at things from, and that would be circadian rhythmicity based on what you do in the morning. Mm-hmm. Because I travel a lot, so mm-hmm. I need to regulate my circadian rhythms quite a bit. Most people know you're supposed to sleep in a relatively cool environment, and you know, I've tracked that, and I've found a significant increase in deep sleep cycles.
Yes.
By sleeping closer to 65 to 68 degrees versus above 70 degrees. I mean, we're talking like a jump from 3 to 5% deep sleep cycles up to 15 to 20%. So,
right.
So cooling is significant, and the nice part about that is you also get an increased release in melatonin. You get improvements in leptin sensitivity, so appetite regulation is better the next day. And you know, most people know about temperature. Most people know about darkness, that you should not only unplug electronic devices that flash in the room because you have photoreceptors on your skin, just like you do on your eyes. But you should, you know, wear a sleep mask or use blackout curtains. And most people know that as well. And then finally, of course, you know, the bedroom should be saved for primarily just sex and sleep. And not a lot of work should be done in the bedroom. But what a lot of people don't think about is what you do the next day. And for example, like I mentioned, I flew in from Minneapolis yesterday, so I'm on Central Time. Yeah, I'm on Central Time. So this morning, I woke up at about 5 a.m., as I expect to do if I'm on Central Time. Normally, my normal wake time would be sometime between about 6:30 and 7. That's about when I get up. Mm-hmm. And so what I did when I woke up was I put on these blue light blocking glasses, right? A lot of people will wear those in the evenings.
Right.
But if I'm trying to reset my circadian rhythm, I'll wear them in the morning, right, to block any blue light from reaching my eyes. And then I wait until the time that I actually want to wake up. I'll wait until the time that I actually want to send my body the signal that it is morning. And there are three basic cues that your body responds to when it comes to circadian rhythmicity. One is exercise or physical movement, which is great. One is a meal, which actually makes the case that intermittent fasting may not be your friend if you're trying to reset your circadian rhythm to be in a new time zone. You should actually eat at the time that would be acceptable for breakfast in that new time zone. But then finally, light is a very important circadian cue. So I use these light-producing devices that aren't near-infrared light, which is great for the reasons we described earlier. But I use one device I have here on my desk next to me. It's this pair of glasses called the Retimers, of course named after the fact that they help with retiming your circadian rhythm. It's a greenish blue light wave spectrum, far easier on the retina and far less damaging to the retina than many of these blue light boxes that people use. And so I'll wear those in the morning, like earlier before the show. You called me. We were doing a sound check at like about 7 a.m. this morning. And I was wearing my glasses at that time while I was sipping my cup of coffee. And I also at the same time had in my ears, because the ears also have photoreceptors that respond to light cues, more of a white light called a human charger. And so what I'll do when I travel or when I've been waking up earlier than I'd like to wake up is I'll wear these blue light blocking glasses until I get to the point of the day where – the point of the morning specifically where I want to send my body the signal that it is indeed morning.
Right.
And then I will put on these glasses and I'll put on little in-ear devices. And this sounds like a lot, but again, remember, I live in Spokane, Washington, and for me to get outside and stare at the sun a lot of times, it's just not feasible in the mornings, especially in the fall or in the winter. So I do the morning light therapy, and that's something that I think a lot of people neglect to do. And, you know, they try all these sleep hacks at night, but you got to remember, good sleep at night starts in the morning.
Yeah. You're absolutely right, and that makes perfect sense. And I've really never thought about it that way. And I have friends who are pilots that this information is going to go right to. You know, for those of us who use peptides, I'll use GHRP6 first thing in the morning if I want to. If I've been traveling and arrived home the night before and I want to resynchronize, because GHRP6 will cause a spontaneous rise in cortisol. And so like you, I'm creating that bookmark. I'm telling my body, this is morning now. Here we are. This is morning. It was different yesterday, but today it's this. But that's brilliant. And that information will go to my good friends who are pilots, because they need – pilots are – you know, flying commercial today is a miserable, miserable profession. And it's not only miserable from the standpoint of how hard they work, but the health issues that they develop from being up in the air, exposed to all types of radiations, but also because their circadian rhythm is lost. It's like it's a thing of the past. You know?
Especially in deep sleep cycles. I've coached some pilots, and the people who I work with, I have them all track their sleep. Most of them use like a ring or some kind of a device. I don't like the devices that generate a Bluetooth or a Wi-Fi signal all night long. I use a ring to track my own sleep that I can put into airplane mode. But I'll have them track their sleep. And another thing, in addition to what I just mentioned for improving deep sleep cycles, like the darkness and the cold and the morning circadian rhythm checks, would be specific nutrients. I mean, anything that will cause a natural release of gamma-aminobutyric acid, I'm a huge fan of. So I like passion flower extract. I even like some of these forms of PH-GABA for deep sleep.
Right.
The other one that there's some really interesting research behind when it comes to enhancing deep sleep cycles is CBD. And using like a CBD vape or a non-THC based CBD. And I've tested THC CBD and non-THC CBD, and non-THC CBD seems to enhance deep sleep cycles even better than the THC version. And interestingly, you seem to get more lucid dreaming and more active dreaming with the non-THC version. So when it comes to nutrients, that's another approach that you can use for the nighttime sleep would be CBD or THC. And then, as you alluded to, in the morning, anything that's going to cause a slight, you know, it's not like you're not already going to be producing some cortisol once you use light and once you wake up and you're up and around, but anything that will cause a release of morning cortisol from caffeine to, you know, the peptides that you mentioned. That's kind of how to get that good 1-2 combo.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
So sleep is a great opportunity for people. If you're not sleeping well now, this is a great opportunity for recovery. What about, you know, people want about nutrition plays a role in recovery, not only just getting adequate calories, but the type of calories. Ever since the, let's say, the love affair with the ketogenic diet over the past 7 or 8 years now, there's been lots of evidence that by reducing certain types of carbohydrates, especially acellular carbohydrates, starchy carbohydrates, which seem to be more pro-inflammatory, that you can actually have a greater effect on recovery, because you don't have this widespread inflammation. You just have inflammation in the muscle that you damaged today, or muscle areas that you've damaged today. And the body can go, oh, I can handle all that. I just can't handle the wildfire that you usually have when you eat potato chips all day long. So do you think that the ketogenic diet has a role in improving recovery? And if so, are you a fan of cyclic keto?
I personally follow cyclic keto. So for about a year and a half, I followed a strict ketogenic diet. I was part of the FASTER study that Jeff Volek ran on a group of elite endurance athletes, where he had one group follow a standard carbohydrate-based diet and one group follow a relatively strict, you know, 85% plus high-fat ketogenic diet with no cyclic ketosis. In my case, it was 12 months that I actually went strict with diet logging and everything for this study. And, I noticed a deleterious effect, not only on sleep, but also on thyroid,
yeah.
Specifically my free, T3 levels, as well as, an increase in my TSH, and a very significant decrease in both total and free testosterone. Of course, accompanied by an enormous increase in endurance performance. So when it comes to having a very bioavailable fuel for the liver and the heart and the diaphragm and a lot of these other organs that I was using during my Ironman triathlon competition. However, most of those hormonal effects were reversed almost immediately once I finished that study and began using cyclic ketosis. And what I mean by that is I eat little to no carbohydrate. If I do have carbohydrate, it's all in the form of plants and vegetables and the occasional squash. You know, like I'll have spaghetti squash sometimes with a full fat coconut milk, you know, stirred up and heated for breakfast with, you know, some cinnamon and some sea salt and
little
vanilla stevia. Yeah, actually
I love spaghetti squash, so this is great.
Oh yeah, it's great. My 9-year-old boys have a food podcast that they publish, and one of their recent episodes was on that very recipe. And so I'll do something like that occasionally for breakfast, but really it's a copious amounts of vegetables and fats all the way up until the evening, between about 4 and 6 p.m. or so. And by the way, one of the reasons for that is because high intensity exercise enhances deep sleep cycles as long as it's finished within 3 hours before bedtime. So I'll do my later afternoon to early evening workout when my body temperature peaks and my grip strength peaks and post-workout protein synthesis peaks and all these advantageous variables occur for a later in the day workout. And then with dinner, I will eat carbohydrates ad libitum, right? Whatever I feel like, you know, sweet potatoes, yams, white rice, quinoa, amaranth, millet, a good organic red wine, a little bit of dark chocolate. And not only have my sleep levels dramatically improved from that approach versus like a ketogenic meal for dinner, but also my testosterone has improved, my thyroid has improved, and so for me, cyclic ketosis is really great. And I'm also a 2-a-day guy, right? So I'll hit the kettlebell sometimes in the morning or do some kind of workout in the morning, and later on in the afternoon be doing some high intensity interval training, and so. For me, going into that morning workout with replenished glycogen stores is also advantageous. And by the way, I've tested. I'm not a fan of constant self-quantification because I think it just sucks all the enjoyment out of life.
Right.
Always writing things down and testing and breathing into tubes and letting blood. But I will test in the morning. And even after those evening forays, because I'm so strict leading up to those evening forays, I'm back into well above 1 millimolar and sometimes up to 3 millimolar of blood ketones by the morning. And that's even with that carbohydrate reload. So even by the time I start my morning workout, I'm back into ketosis. Yeah. So I'm a big fan of that cyclic keto approach.
And, you know, from an evolutionary standpoint, being in ketosis all the time is telling your body the environment is somewhat hostile. We don't have an abundance of food. We'll survive, but it's not a good time to make babies. So sex hormones start to dip. It's also probably a wise time to conserve energy just in case we get a little too far down this rabbit hole and it doesn't work out. So the thyroid goes, okay, well, we'll start saving calories. So what you see when you go keto too long or keto, I don't know the right way to say it anymore. What we see is the body actually goes into a pre-starvation mode. It says, you know, we're alive. We're okay. We seem to be getting a lot of calories from this particular group, but not the abundance that we used to have. And so we probably need to be in a somewhat cautious mode.
And you'll even start
storing body fat. This is what people don't get. They're like, well, I've been keto for 7 months and I can't lose any more body fat. Well, don't be keto anymore for a while.
Yeah, and you really don't see any down regulation in metabolic rate if you were to test this via indirect calorimetry at a metabolic laboratory, or any significant increase in TSH until you've followed that type of calorie deprivation or strict ketosis for about 4 weeks. But the cool thing is you can take advantage of that slight desperation that the body goes into with mild elongated ketosis of, say, a week. When it comes to, you know, for example, I'm a hunter. I bow hunt. I'll be going out after our Thanksgiving turkey here later on this week. And when I do longer hunts, like for elk or deer up in the high country, and I like to hunt elk in Colorado, for example, I'll use ketosis and see a significant increase in sensory perception.
Yeah.
And in alertness and in the ability to be able to go after an animal, because you're tapping into that ancestral mechanism of you not being extremely well fed, and you actually see an increase in your ability to be kind of a predator. And you know, complete aside and related to that, but when you combine something like that with anything that can improve sensory perception,
yes,
color vibrancy, etc., and I will actually I'll microdose with shrooms and be in ketosis when I hunt. And, you know, it kind of flies under the radar, and a lot of hunters will snicker at this, but that's like the ultimate biohack if you're going to,
yeah,
hunt. It, because you get the improvement in perception, you get the slight desperation from ketosis, and you just turn into a complete animal.
You're almost telepathic, most likely, because you're so in tune with your environment that you sense things that are about to happen because you're sensing them from far away. I totally get it.
You can sense every little rustle of the tiniest leaf when you're in that state.
You know, it's funny. Have you read Dr. Melinda Watfey's book of Doves, Diplomats, and Diabetes?
I haven't. I've heard of that one, though.
I'm going to send you a copy after the show, because what he talks about in that book is exactly the ancestral response to hunger. So, you know, the peptides for fear are squelched by the peptides for hunger. That's no accident, because you had to get up the courage to get out of the cave and run the risk of becoming food in order to go find some food. And what you talk about, the moments of desperation, the moments of like, wow, I'm in ketosis, so I'm telling my body things aren't really that great. Everybody needs to wake up, all hands on deck. All your senses tune up. They're like, oh, man, everybody, there's no time to slack here. Everything turns up because you sent your body a signal that would have happened to you anyway a million years ago on the savannah when you were really, really hungry and like, man, if I don't catch something this afternoon, I'm in trouble.
Yeah, it's a polar opposite of a food coma.
Yes, I'm going to send you his book after the show. You're going to read some of this stuff and you're going to go, this is exactly what I was talking about. All right, look, we're going to take a quick commercial break. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with more Ben Greenfield.
This is the Superhuman Channel, doing reps with the weight of the world.
You
Welcome back. We're talking Ben Greenfield. His website is bengreenfieldfitness.com. So, since we were talking about CBD oil and stuff like that a little while ago, do you think CBD has a role in performance and or recovery?
Oh, it definitely has a role in recovery. I mean, it's a pretty potent anti-inflammatory. In terms of performance, most of the studies are pretty anecdotal on CBD and performance. Meaning that a lot, you know, like a lot of ultra runners, for example, and I've done this before as well for some marathoning, obstacle course racing, et cetera, will use CBD, even CBD with small amounts of THC to enhance focus and to decrease pain during longer workouts. However, when it comes to a direct ergogenic effect, I haven't seen a lot of data on CBD as an ergogenic aid as much as CBD as an anti-inflammatory. And the type of CBD that I use is actually blended with curcumin to not only make it water soluble, but to enhance that anti-inflammatory effect even more. So I would say it comes in handier as more of a recovery aid, you know, like we were talking
post-workout.
About earlier.
Yeah.
Not post-workout. I stay away from anti-inflammatories post-workout for the same reason I stay away from ice baths and cold baths post-workout is because I don't want to shunt that hormetic response to exercise. Now, I'll generally wait several hours to take any anti-inflammatories or antioxidants post-workout. So, for example, if I'm working out in the morning and doing like a high intensity training session like I was talking about earlier in the afternoon or the evening, I might do some antioxidants or some anti-inflammatories around lunch or before bed. But I try and have at least a 2 to 3 hour separation so I get a rise in endogenous antioxidant production. And then I'll take something like CBD or curcumin or any of those other antioxidants at a separate time. The other scenario where I'll use like a high dose curcumin or a CBD because it literally just has this muscle melting effect is before deep tissue work, you know, whether self-inflicted, you know, with the roller or the ball. Cause I have, each week I have one session that I'll do for about 60 to 90 minutes where I'll literally hit every single body part with, you know, I have a big box in my living room that's got just every torture device known to man, you know, from sticks to rollers to vibrating balls to, you know, the tiniest of deep tissue devices. And rather than paying a massage therapist to come to my house, I will pop a bunch of CBD or I'll even vape a little bit of THC or CBD. I'll take a whole bunch of curcumin and then just mash my muscles for about 60 to 90 minutes. And I come out of that session even feeling better than I do from a massage because rather – I don't know if you've experienced this. You know, you're working with a massage therapist and you're trying to be polite to them, but at the same time, you're like, no, you're not working at the place you need to. You need to go harder there, harder here. And you know, unless you have a really good relationship with your therapist, sometimes that can be hard and awkward. And I find that once you know your way around with a few little deep tissue tools, you can pretty much call the shots and give yourself your own deep tissue therapy. But I find that I need to melt and relax my muscles beforehand. So I'll use CBD for something like that. Like I mentioned, I'll use CBD for sleep. I'll use CBD for longer aerobic runs that are just more of those type of sessions where you need to focus and shut down pain, where you'll just play some deep house music and run with a little bit of CBD or THC in your system. But yeah, I don't really use it pre-workout. I find that it has too much of a relaxing effect.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I would imagine so. When I was powerlifting, I used to like to use a little THC post workout because I was using stims and my training was so mentally intensive. Just not being crushed by the weight or blowing a disc out of my spine. That afterwards, I would find that I was wound up for hours and. Then I figured out that, you know, like a one hit and bam. And it was like, wow, I just went on vacation all of a sudden. You know, it was just, this is really great. And I had no proof, but I had to believe for me, it was by taking me down a couple notches that had to be good for my recovery too, because it had a very soothing effect for me.
Yeah. And I don't know if you're aware of this, but last month, the World Anti-Doping Association removed CBD from its list of banned substances.
I did not know that.
So they prohibited natural and synthetic cannabinoids. But if you go and look at the WADA list of banned substances, you'll see a very clear exception there where they list cannabidiol or CBD as something completely separate from natural cannabinoids, right, like cannabis or hashish or marijuana, something completely separate from synthetic cannabinoids like THC or any other cannabis mimetic, you'd call it. But cannabidiol is completely legal based off at this point on what a WA or WADA considers. So it is interesting that you can use it for recovery and be free and clear if you're competing in a sanctioned sport.
We're supposed to be growing some of the most amazing hemp for the production of CBD, specifically here in Kentucky.
Really?
Kentucky. So there's a great book called Cornbread Mafia. And it's about how a small area of Kentucky called Raywick County became the pot-growing capital of the United States, contrary to what people think about Humboldt County and all that sort of stuff. Back then, a guy named Johnny Boone, you have to go back to Prohibition. When Prohibition hit Kentucky and Kentucky's main commodity was booze, they had to find something else to grow. And they had all these cornfields that they were growing the corn for the mash and stuff like that. And somebody started growing marijuana, and they just hollowed out these cornfields. They take 100-acre cornfields, and they'd leave the perimeters up. But they would grow pot inside of them. And this was going on here for decades until Raywick County Sheriff's Department got the money to buy a helicopter. And then they figured out what was going on. How all these farmers were driving brand new Cadillacs and building these huge farmhouses and their kids were driving brand new cars. They just couldn't figure it out what's going on here. And so the genetics that they produced here in Kentucky are famous all over the world. They call it Kentucky bluegrass. Well, they are leveraging that pedigree and they are growing some of the most amazing hemp. They don't even want to call it industrial hemp because the word industrial implies this crude ragweed. They're growing hemp here now that is exclusively for CBD, that the terpene content, there's so much more in hemp than just the CBD. All we get high about is, CBD. The terpenes, there's all sorts of great stuff in hemp. They're growing it here in Kentucky now.
That's fascinating. And do you know regarding Kentucky hemp where they're at in terms of glyphosate exposure to hemp over there?
We have organic hemp here. We have organic. Now you and I both know that glyphosate is airborne.
Exactly.
So it would have to be tested for glyphosate, absolutely for sure, for someone to.
Yeah.
But we actually have organic hemp. In fact, all the hemp being grown right now for CBD is certified organic hemp.
Yeah, well, there's not many. Speaking of glyphosate, there's not many like supplements that my children take, but the one thing that they do is a shot of lignite extract before every meal because of what you just alluded to, the fact that a lot of glyphosate gets blown about, and even organic crops now have glyphosates on them, and really interesting research. If you look it up on lignite, which is a specific soil extract on intestinal barrier function in what's called glyphosate-mediated tight junction injury.
No kidding.
And what that means is that the leaky gut and the issues with glyphosate can be mediated by taking a shot of this lignite. And it's kind of annoying. I can't travel with it because it's a great big liquid bottle. They need to figure out how to make it into like a capsule or a powder. But it's my kids take a fermented cod liver oil. They take a vitamin D, vitamin K2 blend, and both of those are for their teeth and bones because I don't want to spend a lot of money on dental care for my kids.
Right.
But the other thing that they'll take before breakfast, lunch, and dinner is they do a shot of this lignite, and it's specifically for the glyphosate issues that you just alluded to.
We've come to the end of the show, and obviously you and I could probably go on for hours, and all this stuff is just so fascinating. The website is bengreenfieldfitness.com. If you've not heard of him, you're lying. It's really been great to have you on the show, man.
Yeah, fascinating. Hopefully people are able now to both get high and expose themselves to copious amounts of infrared light and go bury themselves in the sand. If
I'm down
for anything.
It. You know what? That sounds like
like a party.
Yeah, I was just gonna say that sounds like a party to me. Let's do that. All right, Ben. Thanks for being here, brother.
All right. Thanks for having me on, Carl.
Take care. All right. So that's the end of today's show. Thanks to Coach Rob Regish for coming on. Check out his website, CoachRobRegish.com, and we'll see everybody tomorrow with more Superhuman Radio. It's just the beginning of the week. We've got lots of great shows. See you then.